Good day and welcome to the Trust for America's Health Ready or Not 2012 conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator, and good morning. My name is Jeff Levy. I'm Executive Director of Trust for America's Health. Thank you for joining us today for the release of our annual report, Ready or Not, Protecting the Public's Health from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. The report is being released by Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. A copy of the full report, including state-specific information, is on our website at www.healthyamericans.org. I'm honored to be joined today by Paul Kienert, who is the Senior Program Officer and Director of the Public Health Team at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and previously served as a health officer in Kane County, Illinois, and in the state of Maine. He has a great deal of firsthand on-the-ground experience with the issues we're talking about today. Before we get started, I want to take a moment to express our sympathies for the families and community of Newtown. The events are a heartbreaking reminder about the importance of ensuring we invest in this as a society in protecting our communities, particularly our most vulnerable members. I'm going to start the call today with an overview of key findings from the report. Then Paul will provide comments and context, and I'll close with some recommendations from the report, and then we'll open up the call for questions. This is the 10th year we've issued Ready or Not, to look at how well prepared the country is to respond to health emergencies, ranging from bioterrorist threats to serious disease outbreaks to extreme weather events. Many of you will remember that the country was caught off guard before the September 11th, 2001, attack and the anthrax attacks, and most of us were surprised by how limited our ability was to respond to major health emergencies. Since then, the country has made a series of strategic investments, which led to significant progress in improving public health preparedness, but we have found that there are continued and persistent gaps in the country's ability to respond to health emergencies. Each year, we develop 10 key indicators to assess health emergency preparedness capabilities in states. These indicators reflect some important areas of preparedness, which taken together offer a composite picture of strengths and vulnerabilities in the nation's preparedness. The indicators represent a snapshot of important areas of health emergency preparedness and are developed in consultation with leading public health experts based on data from publicly available sources or information provided by public officials. It is not a comprehensive analysis, but we feel it is important to conduct this report each year because we believe that the public deserves to know how prepared their states and communities are to respond to public health emergencies. The scores are not intended to serve as a reflection on the performance of officials at specific state or local health departments, since they reflect a much broader context, including resources, policy environments, and the health status of a community. Rather, the report identifies where sufficient action has been taken to support adequate public health preparedness and where improvements must be made to overcome obstacles to achieving a solid baseline of preparedness to protect every American, no matter where they live. In this year's Ready or Not, overall, 35 states and Washington, D.C. scored a 6 or lower out of the 10 key indicators. 5 states tied for the highest score of 8 out of 10, Maryland, Mississippi, North Carolina, Vermont, and Wisconsin. 2 states had the lowest score, 3 out of 10, which were Kansas and Montana. Some key findings from the report are as follows. 29 states cut public health funding from fiscal years 2010-11 to 2011-12, with 23 of these states cutting funds for a second year in a row and 14 for 3 consecutive years. This has a huge impact on public health preparedness. 35 states and Washington, D.C. do not currently have complete climate change adaptation plans, including plans for addressing the health effects of extreme weather events. This past year, we saw the impact of Superstorm Sandy, as well as record rainfall in the Pacific Northwest, 2 major hurricanes, a serious derecho windstorm, severe heat in Wisconsin, and other extreme weather events with health implications. 26 states in Washington, D.C. do not have nurse licensure compacts, which allows nurses to be licensed to practice in other participating states when needed. The issue of whether health professionals were licensed to practice in other states was a problem during Superstorm Sandy, when some medical professionals couldn't help out across state lines, even when they were a matter of a few miles apart because of licensing concerns. 48 states in Washington, D.C. have states and Washington, D.C. do not require Medicaid to cover flu shots with no copayment requirements for beneficiaries under the age of 65, which is troubling given that CDC recommends all adults get a flu shot each year, and many Americans who are Medicaid beneficiaries are the most vulnerable to health problems. 20 states do not mandate that all licensed child care facilities have a multi-hazard written evacuation and relocation plan, which is data from, and this is data from a recent report by Save the Children on protecting children during emergencies. A number of groups, including Save the Children, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the Children's Health Fund, have been focusing on special issues of children, families, and emergency preparedness for years, and have a number of recommendations of actions we should all be thinking about in the weeks ahead to help better address these needs. As we saw this past week, things like having plans and procedures in place and having practiced emergency evacuation and relocation plans, having established communications plans for reaching families, and having mental health services for communities who are struggling after emergencies is incredibly important. Also in the report, we found 13 state public health laboratories report they do not have capacity to work 5 12-hour days for 6 to 8 weeks in response to an infectious disease outbreak, such as a novel influenza A, H1N1. Of all the indicators, the trend of continued cuts to public health departments' budgets is particularly troubling. In addition to the 29 states cutting their public health budgets, CDC funding for, which is federal funding for state and local preparedness, has been cut 38% from fiscal year 2005 to fiscal year 2012 when you adjust for inflation. This means the progress that has been made in the past 10 years is starting to erode. More than 45,700 state and local public health jobs have been cut since 2008, and health departments around the country report they are having to cut core capabilities, which means we'll be less prepared the next time a disaster strikes. Right now, however, our report found that the biggest threats to public health preparedness are budget cuts and complacency. So with that general overview, I will turn the call over to Paul Kienert, who is Senior Program Officer and Director of the Public Health Team at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Paul?
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning, everyone. Each year, the Ready or Not report represents an opportunity to reflect on public health preparedness at the community, state, and national levels to understand how far we have come and how far we need to go. As you mentioned, I have served on the ground in responding to public health emergencies, both as a county health officer in Kane County, Illinois, and as director of public health emergency preparedness for the state of Maine. And I cannot underscore enough the importance of our health departments maintaining the ongoing ability to respond to a wide range of health threats, ranging from floods and ice storms to H1N1 flu and West Nile virus. The importance of being prepared for health emergencies cannot be diminished. Quite frankly, as a country, we have not paid sufficient attention to setting a baseline of preparedness that every community should expect, and we haven't provided enough resources for states and localities to adequately respond to threats that they may face. Obviously, it's impossible to be prepared for every scenario, but it is possible and essential to maintain a basic core level of preparation and response capabilities in our health departments, just like we do with fire and police departments all around the country. We have learned a lot about how to respond to a wide range of threats and continually break new ground and tackle emerging issues. For instance, just within the past 18 months, we faced the Joplin tornadoes and Superstorm Sandy, which required extensive evacuation and relocation of citizens and hospital patients during a time when power and other systems in the surrounding areas were down. And public health work doesn't stop right after a disaster. For example, Sandy left behind many health problems in its wake, including contaminated floodwater, unsafe drinking water, food poisoning and access to food, toxic mold, long-term mental health impacts, and many others. Following the destruction that was caused by Sandy, many health departments and public health organizations responded with support and resources for individuals and communities. And I'd like to share a few examples. For instance, officials in New Jersey managed a range of coordination and response efforts to Sandy among public health officials, volunteers, healthcare professionals, and first responders. Many healthcare workers in the state worked overtime in hospitals and nursing homes, and volunteers helped in shelters to provide medical care and assistance to those in need. Staff from Hoboken University Medical Center and Palisades Medical Center, two centers that were evacuated in Hudson County, moved with their patients to other hospitals and remained there to help. At Newark Beth Israel Medical Center and St. Barnabas Medical Center, six life-saving transplants were performed while the medical centers were on generator power. And to date, 27 states have deployed over 2,500 personnel and equipment through the Emergency Management Compact, which is a national interstate mutual aid agreement allowing states to share resources across state lines during disasters. The Department of Health in New Jersey established a hotline within days of the storm and staffed that hotline with public health experts who answer questions on mold cleanup, food safety, and drinking water concerns. Health departments also have ensured access to prescription medications to uninsured residents affected by the storm through the Emergency Prescription Assistance Program. Life-saving public health initiatives like newborn screening in New Jersey continued to operate without interruption, even though the state health lab was hard hit by the storm. Mobile screening trucks were deployed to offer tetanus shots, flyers about mold, and hand sanitizer to affected populations during the storm cleanup. Local health departments also coordinated getting pets to pet shelters and then back to their owners after the storm. Local health departments had to be very creative about getting critical health messages out to the community, given the fact that residents and many of the health departments were without power. They realized that many folks did have crank radios, and it was their only form of contact, so they used outreach through radio interviews and PSAs. Health departments also inspected donated foods and meals while coordinating with food banks and aid groups to quickly assess and deploy the food to those who needed it most. The health departments also coordinated with environmental health units to assess and respond to potential issues with leaked natural gas, home heating oil, generators, and other safety issues like carbon monoxide poisoning. The response to Sandy really has been inspiring. It provides a very clear set of examples of the important role public health plays in these times of need. Ready or Not documents other major preparedness accomplishments as well, ranging from advances in the ability to rapidly test for biological and chemical threats to improvements in the ability to distribute vaccinations or medicines to the public in the event of a mass emergency, to setting up programs to be able to quickly assemble volunteer medical personnel during an emergency. But again, as Jeff mentioned earlier, the report also serves as an important and strong reminder of the challenges we still face. For instance, the federal, state, and local budget cuts to public health preparedness documented in the report are very alarming, and they are putting all of our past success at risk, making it harder to tackle the areas where we still need to improve. At the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we believe that public health departments play a central role in making healthy communities possible. And thinking back to my recent experiences in Illinois and dealing with extreme weather events like the record blizzard in the Chicago area in 2011, I know that communities can't be healthy if their health departments aren't fully prepared to protect those they serve from emergencies and disasters. That's why Ready or Not continues to be such an important report for all of us who work to strengthen public health. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I'd like to wrap up with some of the high-level recommendations featured in the report. The report goes into more detail on each one, but some of the recommendations for addressing some of the gaps that we still have in emergency health preparedness include First, the need to reauthorize the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, known as PAHPA. That expires at the end of this year. That's sort of the equivalent of the fiscal cliff that preparedness is about to go over. It's expected to be voted on or under suspension on the floor of the House today, but we're awaiting more action on the Senate side where things seem to have been stalled. We also need to be assuring sufficient dedicated funds for public health preparedness to ensure basic capabilities to respond to threats public health departments face every day, and also have trained experts and systems in place to act quickly in the face of major and unexpected emergencies. We need to be providing ongoing support to communities so they prepare for and cope with and recover from emergencies. For example, public health departments should be establishing ongoing relationships with members of their community, particularly vulnerable members of the community, which helps when emergencies happen, but also help to support better health overall. We tend to call that community resiliency in public health, and you will see in the report several commentaries by people in the field who talk about the value of that resiliency and that ongoing relationship. Because while news of coverage of disasters tapers off after a couple of weeks, the needs in those communities continue, and that includes the need for mental health services and support. So there are these long-lasting effects, whether it's from 9/11, whether it's from Hurricane Katrina, whether it's other emergencies, and we should not forget. We also have recommendations around modernizing the biosurveillance system to a real-time interoperable system to better detect and respond to problems, so we have better situational awareness, both in terms of the threats that are happening and the health needs of people in the community during an emergency. We have a section on addressing the problem of antibiotic resistance, which remains a real challenge in our ability to respond to certain both naturally occurring and bioterrorist threats. We need improved research, development, and manufacturing of medical countermeasures, and we need increased readiness for extreme weather events. And finally, we need, and certainly not least, we need to be updating the nation's food safety system. In closing, we have come a long way since 2001 in preparing and responding to health emergencies. However, as this report shows, there are still significant risks to our nation's core public health capacity, which could have tragic consequences if we start to backslide. With that, we'll now open up the call for questions, and I'd like to remind everyone that the report and state-by-state indicators and individual state news releases are online at our website, healthyamericans.org. Operator.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you have signaled for a question prior to hearing these instructions on today's call, please repeat the process now by pressing star and 1, again, to ensure our equipment has captured your signal. And we'll pause just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Again, it's star 1 for questions, and we'll go first to Mr. Bob Rose.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I had two questions, actually. I wondered if you could talk about the 10 indicators that you used in the report. Are these the same as in past years, or do you use a different set? Does it change somewhat from year to year? And also, either speaker, could you talk a little bit more about the PAHPA Act and what's at stake with that as far as public health funding?
Sure. We actually didn't use indicators last year, and prior years we did. We do not use the same indicators each year. Some of these are the same as we had used in prior years, but not all of them have. That's for several reasons. One is new issues arise, and it's important to pay closer attention to them. So the climate change the climate change indicator would be a good example of that. As we experience new emergencies, we learn new things, and so I think that's important. But certain core indicators have been stable over time, including the one around flu vaccination, the one around public health funding, those kinds of things I think are continue to be important. So this is a snapshot in time. The Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act authorizes a number of programs, including some of the basic research and development of new drugs and countermeasures, which is critically important. We've also been looking for new authorities in this legislation to give more flexibility to state and local health departments to respond to emergencies and to really be able to, you know, do sort of an all-hands-on-deck approach to response. So there's a series of things, and they are outlined as well in more detail in the report, of the kinds of things that we are looking for in reauthorization. So, we're hopeful that this will ultimately pass. This has been a bipartisan effort, but nonetheless, we are concerned that we are able to move forward.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Bradley George of WPLN.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my question. About the whooping cough numbers, could you talk about why states are having trouble meeting that federal target?
Sure. Paul, do you want to start or do you want me to handle that?
Sure, I can jump in. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that, we are facing funding cuts in public health from both the state, local, and federal level. So that, as we've seen, has eroded some of the capacities of health departments to maintain their core services. Another factor that has had an impact on pertussis vaccination levels in particular has been the anti-vaccine movement and, you know, the shifting attitudes of parents around childhood vaccines and their perceived issues around safety that some parents have. So I think the combination of those two factors has had a real impact on, unfortunately, seeing decreases in vaccine coverage for children across the country.
Have you seen, even with states that haven't met the goal, you've been able to close the gap, maybe get closer to it? And like
well,
what they've done to do that?
Right. I think what this pertussis outbreak, particularly in Washington and Wisconsin, has kind of re-energized many health departments. Many health departments are doing a lot of outreach and education with parents, again, trying to address the concerns that parents have. And we're beginning to see, I think, a number of areas that are making progress there. But again, it just kind of goes to the point of how important it is to maintain these core capacities of public health departments to address, you know, ongoing kind of routine issues like vaccination that in turn kind of tie into capacities during emergencies to quickly respond and give vaccinations or distribute medications during the time of an emergency.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying, just to be clear, I mean, you're saying more that this may be more of a thing with the parents and this anti-vaccine movement versus health departments having the means to vaccinate kids.
I think it's a combination of both of those factors in the case of pertussis, where, you know, there has been some impact from this anti-vaccine movement, and it's, exacerbated by the funding and resource decreases in state and local health departments.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I also think it's an important reminder that I think for a lot of people, you know, whooping cough was something from prior generations, and one of the reasons it appeared to be from prior generations is we had done such a good job of vaccinating folks, and once you become complacent about this, we see a resurgence of old bugs, not just new bugs.
All right, thank you.
And as a reminder, it's *1 for your questions today. That's *1. And we'll take our next question from Zach Geiger of the Altoona Mirror.
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call. Question about the fungal meningitis outbreak. a couple months ago. What can be done to, you know, kind of handle that oversight and, I guess, alert the public, you know, when problems like this do arise? How is it best to spread that message and let people know, you know, what health options are available to them?
Well, why don't I start with sort of the national issues, and maybe Paul can talk a little bit about how local health departments respond to these kinds of issues. But, you know, I think one of the things that was very clear in this instance was the need to clarify the Food and Drug Administration's authority in regulating these kinds of facilities. And I think that's, you know, at a national level, the biggest challenge is that we have been reluctant, you know, we always have this tension about the level of regulation we want over these kinds of facilities and the division of labor that exists to some degree between the federal government and states in regulating these facilities. And so I think the first step to address this in the future is to clarify the FDA's authority and then give the FDA the resources they need to do the inspections and do the oversight. That is critical, you know, whether it's this meningitis challenge or even on the food safety side where, you know, Congress made the decision that we need stronger oversight for food safety. We've been slow in getting new regulations out, but also have not provided the FDA with the additional resources that come with effective exercise of that authority. Want to add anything?
Yeah, I think what I would add is that on the local and state level, this goes to two kind of key capacities that health departments need to have. And one is the ability to detect something unusual going on. You know, so being able to pick up early the indications that there's a new infection that's being spread or some cluster or small group of people that have a set of symptoms that are in common. And the other piece is really the ability to then communicate effectively and rapidly both with healthcare providers and with members of the public around what's going on and what needs to be done about it. So typically, health departments, through these emergency preparedness funds that we've been talking about, have really been able to build up their capacity to do both of those things, so to have the staff and to work with the hospitals on the early detection, to work with the laboratories on early detection, and then actually to have the laboratory testing capabilities to detect something new and different, and then to be able to respond quickly with information that people need. So it's a very good illustration of exactly why we need to have these resources on an ongoing basis to be able to respond to threats.
And we'll take our next question from Diane Barnes of National Journal Group.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if your reports call for a real-time interoperable biosurveillance system implies endorsement either of BioWatch or of any other capabilities specifically targeting bioterrorist threats. Thank you.
We're not necessarily endorsing a specific approach. BioWatch is more a series of, you know, is sort of a monitoring system that's separate, I think, from, you know, the electronic health record system. I think what our BioSense is the program that does create that linkage. But I think the bottom line here is what we are saying and is consistent with, I think, where the administration is moving in terms of their strategy on biosurveillance, is that we need to be harnessing new technologies. The move to high-tech approaches to health information technology give us an opportunity to learn so much more about what is happening to the public health in terms of identifying new threats, but also in having situational awareness during an emergency. So, you know, I think, you know, some contrasting examples here might be, you know, that after after the tornado in Joplin, Missouri, where the St. John's Hospital had actually recently converted to electronic health records, and that hospital had to be shut down during the emergency. It was a relatively seamless transfer of patients because they could transfer the electronic health information. So there would be continuity of care, continuity of prescriptions, and a real awareness of what people needed. I think we saw some real challenges in Hurricane Sandy as hospitals were evacuated, and there weren't interoperable electronic health records. The other piece to that from a public health standpoint is that a good electronic health record system where public health departments have the resources to tap into those records while assuring privacy, they can then know what kinds of services for chronic diseases, so who are people who may be stranded, who need help with their diabetes medications, or may have lost power and need help with certain equipment. Those kinds of things can be drawn from electronic health records in a much more systematic way. So the VA system, which does have a very robust electronic health system, was able to not only assure continuity of care as people moved from one facility to another, but also could identify who was homebound, who needed services, and might be affected if power went out. So the opportunities around electronic health records to really dramatically improve what we know and how effectively we respond is incredibly important and is one of the things that we highlight in the report.
And we'll take our next question from Ashok Seldman of Modern Healthcare Magazine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was looking at the report yesterday and today, and it seems everywhere we'd like more money to fund our programs, and in particular for emergency preparedness. I don't know how feasible that is to restore funding or to increase funding. I wanted to ask you, how feasible is it to restore funding, or is it just a matter of becoming more efficient with the resources that exist right now?
I think, Paul has had much more direct experience on the ground with how you deal with diminished resources and try to assure efficiency, but I think we've certainly reached a point where, constantly doing more with less, there's a limit to what can be achieved there and how much you can do. And this is in the area of preparedness and in a lot of public health, it's a pay now or pay later situation. You can pay now up front and invest in making sure we have the systems in place to protect people, or we can spend a lot more money in dealing with an immediate disaster. And the checkbooks open up when we're the government checkbooks open up in the middle of a disaster, and appropriately so. But a lot of that money could have been saved had we done more work up front. Paul, do you want to add to that?
I think what we have seen is that over the past 6-7 years, the federal preparedness dollars have decreased by almost 40%. And then in addition, you have state and local government making additional cuts to public health budgets. So I think health departments really have done a remarkable job in coping with those cuts and doing more with less, becoming more efficient. But by and large, we're kind of beyond that point where efficiencies are going to be able to make it possible for local health departments to cope with these kinds of issues. And I think what we need to realize kind of as a country is that just like fire and police departments, health departments really need to be ready to respond to disasters and protect their communities, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so we just, I think, have to prioritize that kind of core public safety and health protection that public health preparedness gives us for our communities.
And a reminder, it's star one to ask your questions today. That's star one. And we go next to Megan Workman of the Charleston Gazette.
Hello. I just want to make sure I just printed the report and I'm reading it while we're on the phone. So I want to make sure I am reading it correctly, and then I had a question from that. So I live in West Virginia, and we're a very unhealthy state, so the fact that we are ranked number one for tobacco use for adults is not surprising, but we are ranked 50th for the number of uninsured who are 18 and under, 2.7%. So I just want to make sure I'm reading it right, that we have the least number of 18 and under who are uninsured in the nation. Is that correct? I'm reading that right, that we're ranked 50th?
That's not our report. I think you were – are you looking at the United – the health rankings report?
That's a great question. I did go to healthyamericans.org.
Yeah.
And I clicked on West Virginia key health data about West Virginia.
Okay. So you were looking at the key health data. I'm assuming that is accurate. But the report that we're talking about is the Ready or Not report. So it's
that's
the 10
why.
Indicators.
That's the wrong one. That's
yeah.
Why. Okay. Well, then disregard my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
And we have no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back over to Mr. Levy for additional or closing remarks.
Okay. Well, thank you all for calling in, and we remain available both at Robert Johnson Foundation and at Trust for America's Health for any follow-up questions. You can find the information at our website, healthyamericans.org, and you can also find us at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation website, rwjf.org. Thank you all, and thank you, Paul Kienert from RWJF, for joining me.
And this concludes today's presentation. Thank you for joining, and have a nice day.